This is Jeff Oswald here at Concordia Seminary with another session of Lectionary at Lunch. Today we want to look at the second reading for the Festival of Pentecost in Year A. The second reading comes from Acts chapter 2 and begins at verse 1. By way of introduction, let me share Tannehill's comments as he opens up this section of his book on the narrative unity of Luke and Acts. Says the Pentecost scene begins abruptly with dramatic events for which there is no discernible cause. Suddenly, there is a mysterious sound, like a strong wind accompanied by tongues as of fire. Briefly, readers may share the puzzlement later expressed by the Jews dwelling in Jerusalem. For we are told first of the mysterious sounds and sights, and only in verse 4 are these connected with the Holy Spirit. I think Tannehill's point is, the way Luke narrates this story lets us experience some of the surprise, some of the suddenness and dramatic character of these events instead of sort of spoiling it for us by telling us, and then the Holy Spirit came upon them in the following way. But as Tannehill continues to say, the Spirit does then initiate the action in this section, and it is this section that initiates the mission that will continue throughout the rest of Acts. So following the period of instruction by the risen Christ, the disciples' time of waiting and learning, now the things are going to happen which Jesus had promised. So the Spirit's arrival results in an outburst of speech following this period of relative silence, and that communicates to Jews from every nation under heaven in their own native languages. Then Peter speaks and interprets these events in a way that can make them meaningful to the audience he's addressing. Tannehill makes this important point, though, that I'd like you to keep in mind as we look at the text itself. He says, Peter's speech not only interprets what has happened, it causes something to happen. The audience makes a shattering discovery and is moved to repentance in large numbers. Through Peter's speech, the mission of Jesus and his witnesses moves to a new level. That's what we want to look at. Barrett makes one other opening comment I'd like to share, and then we can get into this text itself. He says, in this section, Luke appears to have two purposes in mind, and again, this is helpful for seeing the overall structure of this text. First of all, to demonstrate the fulfillment of Jesus' promise. He had told them to wait until power came upon them, and now power has come upon them. The second, he says, amplifies the first. The church from the beginning, though at the beginning located only in Jerusalem, is in principle a universal society in which universal communication is possible. That is, this new Israel will be composed of all nations, and though it will begin here, it will spread forth, and this word will go out to every land. Okay, let's turn to Acts chapter 2 then, verse 1, and we begin, Kai ento simple rusthai tein hemerantes pentecostes. Okay, we begin with an infinitive that has the article and is preceded by the preposition en. If you remember that construction, it usually means while the action of the infinitive is happening, and that action is then background for something else that's going to happen, the main action. And the subject of the action of the infinitive then is usually put in the accusative, and that's why hemeron is accusative here. So, very woodenly, in the coming to fulfillment of the day, with the day that is as the action, the day of the 50th, or what we simply call the day of Pentecost. Now, it seems strange to say a day would come to fulfillment. In a simple way, we could look at this as the 50 days coming to their full number. But Luke also will use the language of fulfillment for things other than promises and sayings. And he will speak of time as coming to fulfillment, especially when there's a real significance for salvation to this. So it's as if we've reached a time marker in God's plan. So this much of the plan has now come to fulfillment. Okay, so when the day came round, is the way Fitzmyer finally decides to translate it, when it came to be, came to pass, came to fulfillment, eisan pantes hamu epi ta auta. Eisan is our main verb here then. They were, namely pantes, all. Hamu is an adverb here that means together in one place, and that's then reinforced with epi ta auta, which means to be at the same place. So they were all together in the same place. Now, who is the they? It's a little difficult to say for certain. Chapter 1 has spoken of sort of at the very end, the narrowly defined group of the 12 apostles, now reconstituted with the addition of Matthias. Earlier, it had spoken of a larger community of Christians numbering about 120. It's hard to know which group is especially in mind when Luke says they were all together. Peter will later speak of men as speaking, but the prophecy of Joel seems to include men, women, old men, young men, so a variety of ages and both sexes. But in terms of the speaking going on, the reaction of the crowd, Peter labels that specifically as men. So perhaps we're meant to think most especially of the apostles themselves at this point. Okay, verse 2. Kai egeneta afno ek tu uranu hekos hosper pheromenes pnoes biaias kai eplerosen holon ton oikon hu eisan kathemenoi. Okay, and kai egeneta, and it came to pass. Remember, this is Luke's borrowing of Septuagintal language to indicate that he is still telling the biblical story. And it came to pass, and notice how choppy this is here, as if he's reporting almost as if he were seeing it, or at least so that as we listen, we can see things one after another. It came to pass, an afno, suddenly, with the adverb, and Barrett points out that suddenness in the scriptures suggests wondrous, awesome events. Certainly in this case, it's true that this is, we immediately suspect at least that this is a supernatural event. That question is answered in the next phrase, ech tu uranu, that this is happening suddenly from heaven. And here heaven certainly as the place where God himself dwells. So what is this that God is doing? Well, we've expected something from on high. Now Luke's going to tell us what it was. And it comes in the form of echos, a noise. A noise hosper, like pheromenes pnoes, a rushing, quickly moving wind. The participle there from furrow, which means to carry something, bear something along, a wind powerful enough to move things, to rush through a room. Pnoes from pnoe, from you can hear the verb pneo, to blow or breathe, here of a wind, and it's described not only as rushing or forceful, but biaios, as strong, even violently strong. So remember, it doesn't say a wind came through, but a sound like a violently strong rushing wind. Kai eplerosen, and it filled, that is, this noise, this sound filled the house. Translator, Barrett, suggests if we use a play on word with echos from that gives us our English echo, we could say it echoed throughout the room. The sound reverberated. It filled the place. The holon ton oikon, the whole house, normally oikos is a house, But here, if we take kathēmenoi, the participle that follows in its more narrow sense of simply sitting, then oikos is probably meant to indicate the room where they were, that is, this common space where they were all together. Again, and it came to pass suddenly from heaven a strong sound like a rushing violent wind, and that sound filled the whole place or room where they were sitting. Kai ophthazon, continuing in verse 3, and there appeared or became visible, that's the passive of horao, autois to them, dia meridzomenai. This is the participle of dia meridzo, which means to be divided, to separate into parts or pieces, glossi. So here, divided tongues. Hose, another word, conjunction that makes a comparison, like hosper, this time comparing the divided tongues to pyros, flames of fire. Kai ekathizen, f hena hekastan auton. And these divided flames, or these divided tongue-shaped things that looked like flames of fire, sat or rested upon each one of them, with the hena hekastan sort of emphasizing the singularity, each single one, each individual one of them. Kai eplaisthazon pantes pneumatos hagiu. And they were filled, this is pimplemi in the aorist passive, so third person, pantes, they all were filled. And then the thing you're filled with is usually put into the genitive. So they were filled with the Holy Spirit. Kai erxanta, they began, the aorist middle of archo, which remember in the middle means to begin something, completed with the infinitive lalein, to speak. And then in the dative, heterais glossais. In, to speak in a language, with a language, with different tongues or languages. Kathos ta pneuma edidu apophthegesthai autois. Here, kathos marks the degree or extent that something happens. To the extent that the Spirit allowed them, here didomi is, as Parsons and Cooley point out, in a kind of causative expression where one person causes or allows another to do something. So as the Spirit allowed them to declare, to speak out, really to make sounds. So this verb apophthegomai is perhaps used here because the disciples, the apostles, weren't actually thinking up these words in foreign languages. They were making the sounds. The Spirit was giving the message, the words, the content. Okay, so not under their own direction or under some other cause, as the crowd will suspect, but just as the Spirit caused this to come about. Okay, verse 5. Eisan de eis Jerusalem katoi kuntes judaioi. Andres eulabes apa pantas ethnus ton hippa ton uranon. Okay, de indicating here a new thought. We're going to sort of back up and set the scene a little bit. Now there were in Jerusalem katoi kuntes, here means to dwell or reside, to stay for some time. These could be long-term guests, as we'll see. But they were dwelling in Jerusalem, Judaioi. Now, this causes us to question a little bit the close association between Judaioi and Judea. If these are Judeans living in other countries, are they still Judeans? And so here, the more traditional translation of Jew, people with Judea as their homeland or ancestral home, may be better. So Jews were living in Jerusalem, men, Andres, eulabes, pious, God-fearing, or devout men, apa pontas ethnus, from every nation, culture, or people group. It's difficult to decide exactly how to translate ethnos in these situations. Certainly, it means living around the world, and Judeans, that is, who are now speaking in other languages and living in other cultures. And then ton, hippa ton uranon, that is, nations from all over under heaven, that is, throughout the earth, on the whole earth. Okay, verse 6, genomines de tes phones tautes. So when this noise, this sound arose or took place from genomines, the aorist participle of genomai, syn eilthen ta plethos. This crowd of people who were now dwelling there in Jerusalem, syn eilthen from syn erchomai, they came together, or they assembled, they gathered. Kai syn ekuthe, and from syn keo, which really means to sort of pour together, that is, mix everything up. They were surprised or agitated. We might even say simply stirred up, right? The crowd was stirred up because hoti ekuon heis hekastos te idia dialecto lalun ton auton. Because ekuon from akuo here in the imperfect, they were hearing each one ta idia dialecto in his own language, them speaking. So they were hearing this spirit-caused proclamation in various languages, and each one heard in his own language what the apostles were saying. 7. Existanta de kai ethaumedzon legontos. Existanta from existemi is the imperfect middle here, which means to be amazed. It's so to speak, stand outside yourself, to have astonishment, fear caused by some extraordinary event. So they were amazed and ethaumedzon, and astonished or marveling, perhaps adding the idea of wanting to know what was going on, saying, legontes, uch idu hapantes hutoi eisen hoi laluntes galileoi. Remember that when uch introduces a question, it usually expects the affirmative answer. These are, aren't they? So it's not so much asking for information as for confirmation of the questioner's view. So idu here forming functioning as an attention getter. Look, behold, it's true, isn't it? Hapantes hutoi, all of these men, these ones who are speaking, they are Galileans, aren't they? Okay, verse 8, kai pos hemes akuomen hekastas te idia dialecto hemon en he egenethemen. And how is it then, how is it possible that, in the context of something that's startling or amazing, how is it possible that we akuomen in the present are hearing each one in his own language, Teidia dialecto again, of us, hemon, that is, each of us in his own language, en he egenethemen, the language in which we were born. That's what it literally means, but probably that is, we would say, our mother tongue, right? The language that's been spoken from infancy. So these were not, so to speak, Judeans who had recently just traveled overseas on business or something. These are people of Judean origin who have lived their whole lives speaking another language. Verse 9. So their questioning, the direct quote of their speech ends, and Luke begins to describe for us the composition of this group. So parthoi, kai meidoi, kai elamitai, kai hoi katoi kuntes tein mesopotamion, Judaion te kai kapadokion, ponton kai tein asion. I'll pause there, although the list has only just got rolling. If you have the Concordia Self-Study Bible, there's a very helpful map in sort of right in the middle of Acts chapter 2 that will help you place these various regions. Let me just describe them briefly. If you want more detail, I would recommend Fitzmyer's Anchor Bible Commentary. He gives some historical connections with these places as well. So we begin with Parthians. They lived in the region southeast of the Caspian Sea, and they are connected then with the Medes. They had been an ancient Indo-European people, and they also live south of the Caspian Sea, but to the on the other side, to the west rather than to the east, where the Parthians are from. So from Jerusalem now, we would be looking almost directly east, a little bit north perhaps, to the great sort of peoples from the east. And then that continues with the Elamites, who are coming now from a district north of the Persian Gulf, Bedag tells us, where around the Tigris River, south of the area of the Medes, but still from a Jerusalem perspective to the east. So we've got Parthians, Medes, Elamites, and those katoi kuntes, again, dwelling in Mesopotamia. So summarizing various visitors from the whole region of the Mesopotamian River. Okay, then Luke continues, Judaion tekai kapadokion. Judeans, the area from which Jerusalem, in which Jerusalem is located, it seems somewhat out of place, but it's found in all Greek manuscripts. It's not to be explained as corruption of the text. But it makes sense as well, if Luke's going to describe the whole area, that there's not simply a gap of those who were local people visiting Jerusalem as well. Moving on then, from Cappadocia, up in Asia Minor now, looking north from Jerusalem, we continue with Pontus. People from Pontus and Asia. This Asia, of course, in the Roman sense of what we think of as Asia Minor, the area of Turkey. So we've moved in a circle, sort of from the east, pivoting around Jerusalem, north and west now. The list continues then in verse 10, Phrygian, Takai, Pamphylion, Aegypton, Kai Tamere, Tes Libyes, Tes Kata, Kyrenein, Kai Hoi Epidemuntes, Romaioi. So we move on to Phrygia. These are areas along sort of the southern edge of what we think of as Asia Minor. And Pamphylia is there too, along that coastal region. Then to Aegypton, one of the more familiar ones to us, now dropping down south, almost completing a circle, complete circle around Jerusalem. Egypt was at this time not only a land with a long and ancient history, a history which had many connections, of course, to the people of Israel, but as Fitzmyer reminds us, this was also the richest country in the Roman Empire. It was mostly from Egypt that Rome fed itself. Okay, and then mere libies kata kirenin. This is a little bit of an unusual expression with the kata there, but most understand this to mean the parts of Libya around Cyrene, the regions about Cyrene, where Cyrene was a territorial capital. And Cyrene, together with Crete, then formed a Roman province, that is a province in the Roman imperial system of Cyrenaica. All of these lands had large Jewish populations, and Philo, for one, mentions large Jewish colonies in many of these places. Okay, then we continue with kai hoi epi de muntes, from epi de meo, to be in town, to stay, that is, visitors who were Romans. And of course, we know that Rome will play a very significant part in the history of this newly forming Christian community in the centuries to come. Now, verse 11 changes tactics a little bit with eudaioi te kai proselitoi, here using Judean probably more in the religious sense, since it's coupled with proselitoi, the proselytes or converts to Judaism, or let's say to the faith of the people of Israel at this time. Cretes kai Arabes. The Cretans, people from Crete, and Arabs. And Fitzmyer says these give us, they expand the territory in a way the other terms hadn't. From the west and to the east, clear out into the Mediterranean Sea, and then down, of course, to the Persian Gulf, Indian Ocean, Red Sea, and so on. So all the regions, the territories around Jerusalem, and here Akuomen, you see in verse 11, I have to correct myself earlier. I said this switched to the narrator's voice, but you see here this is still the crowd now speaking amongst themselves. So they are enumerating their own composition, and after that long list of various groups of people, they say, we are hearing them speaking, lalunton auton, tes hemeterais glosses ta megalea tu theu. We are hearing them speaking in our own languages the great things of God, the great deeds or actions, the wonderful things God has done. So here we get some indication of what the content of this was, not just its astounding nature as being in so many different foreign languages, but that there really was a message there. Verse 12, existanta de pantas kai diaporun. So here Luke picks up again the narration, drawing on the word he had used to describe them back in verse 7. They were amazed, and diaporeo, here you can see the dia, the kind of the divided idea. They were greatly perplexed. Alas pros alan legantes. So one to another saying, ti thele tu ta enai. This is a strange question. Again, translating it very woodenly, you would get, what does this wish to be? Bedag glosses the question as, what can this mean? Which is certainly an unusual way to take thello. Barrett warns against limiting the question too much to the idea of meaning, because he says people really didn't know what was going on at all, not as if they understood the event and were looking for its significance. They simply couldn't figure out what was happening. So we might simply say, what's going on here? What's all this about? Which may capture a little bit of that flavor of thele. 13, then, heteroi de, diakluadzontes elagon hoti glucus memesto menoi asin. So they were all wondering, but others, that is some group within this larger group that was all astounded, were jeering, saying with the derisive laughter and scorn that, no, there's a different explanation for all of this. We'll tell you what's going on. Glucose is a word for sweet new wine. Memistomenoi is from mestao. This is a perfect passive participle, and it means to be full of. And you put into the genitive the noun that something is full of, which is generally the case. And glucose here is from glucos, third declension noun, so the us ending is its genitive singular. It's not a, you know, o declension accusative plural, as you might think at first glance. So they are filled, full of new wine. Now remember, this is the Pentecost time, the celebration of the early harvest, and there are indications that one of the things that was part of the celebration was the testing of the year's new wine, sort of like the Beaujolais Nouveau, I guess. So there may be a sort of natural connection between the time when this is happening and the kind of mockery that the apostles were suffering. Okay, so that's the first half of the passage, which sort of sets up the action, describes what happened on that first Christian Pentecost. Verse 14 then switches now to Peter's own words as he's going to try to explain what's happening. So, stathes deha petros sun tois hendeka ep eren tein phonein autu kai apophthegza ta autois. So, stathes from histemi to step up, to stand, to be in a place where people can hear him. Notice how Luke describes Peter as standing up with the 11, that is his 11 fellow apostles, but then in the singular from ep iro in the aorist here, he raised his voice, and apophthegzata from apophthegomai, again aorist middle here, connecting this back, I think, to that spirit given speech in verse 4, he now pronounces, he declares, autois to them, andres eudaioi. This is a very common Greek way of addressing a crowd, to put these two vocative nouns side by side. You can even have in Greek literature something that seems as strange as andres theoi, when someone is addressing the gods. Here, it's usually the andres is dropped and you get Judeans, but it's hard to catch the exact flavor of this in English. Not quite like brothers, not quite that intimate, but men, Judeans, that is men of Judea, and those, again, katoi kuntes, all those staying in Jerusalem, dwelling in Jerusalem at this festival time, that is, tuta humin gnoston esto. Esto is the third person imperative of ami. Let it be known. This thing must be known, humin, by you. Gnoston there is the adjective for what's known, and then the person is put in the dative. This must be known by you. Kai enotisaste ta hremata mu. Pay careful attention. Since this must be known, then pay careful attention to my words, to the things I'm proclaiming to you. 15. Ugar hos himes hippa lambaneta hutoi methuosen. For not hos himes, as you think. The hos introduces a comparison, but here you have the comparison before you actually know what it's being compared with. But hippa lambano here means to suppose, to be of the opinion, and in this case clearly we see it's a wrong opinion or supposition. Not as you think that these men, again from methuo, to be drunk, to be intoxicated. Methu is the a Greek word for wine. We saw that also as a well, not quite the same verb, but a similar idea in the preceding verse. So they are wined, intoxicated. Estin gar hora trite tes hemeras, because it's only the third hour. It's only 9 o'clock in the morning. I suppose in certain situations that wouldn't be a persuasive argument. But here, certainly, if someone had been celebrating, you would expect them to be drunk in the evening and sick in the morning. Not up, you know, at this hour of the morning and proclaiming the powerful deeds that God has done. 16. Allah. So contrary to that, to what you think, tuta esten ta eremenon dia tu prophetu Yoel. Rather, this is, in fact, the thing that was spoken through the prophet Joel. Now, remember, this is Peter's interpretation of the things that have happened. I think this citation of the passage from Joel is often not given enough attention in discussions in the church today about what Pentecost means or even what it meant. Okay, verse 17 then, Kai estai in tais eskatais hemerais lege hotha os. And it will be, the estai here is a kind of, again, Hebrew language taken over into Greek by the translators of the Septuagint. It's in many ways similar to Luke's kai egenita, and it will be, in the last days, says God, ek keo apa tu pneumatasmu epi pasan sarka. It will be that I will pour out. Ek keo is a sort of strange future from ek keo. Ek keo, you can see it's the accent is changed there. That I will pour out apa from my spirit. Here, apa as a partitive genitive idea. So from sort of the abundance of the spirit of the Lord, he will pour out upon pasan sarka, all flesh, that is, everyone. Kai prophe tu susen hoi huioi hemon, kai hai thugateres hemon. And they will prophesy from prophe tuo, your sons and your daughters. Those are the two nominative subjects of the third plural verb there. Kai hoi neaniskoi hemon, horases opsontai. And your neoniskoi are young men, youth, not a very precisely defined term, but contrasted with in presbyteroi in the next line. Your young men will see, opsontize, the future of harao. Horasis then is something that you do see, a vision, and this is the accusative plural. It's a third declension, horasis, Horaseos. Okay. Kai hoi presbyteroi hemon enipnios enipnias thesontai. Here again you see the almost poetic use of cognate objects, cognate accusatives with the verbs. So you will see visions and you will dream dreams. And you can see that these are the things that happen while you are sleeping, en-hip-no, that kind of root. Okay, so the young will see visions. The old, the elderly, will have visions in dreams or dream dreams, as we might say. Kai ge epi tus dulusmu, kai epi tas dulasmu, en tais hemerais ekenais. Kai ge is a strengthened form of and, making it intensive. And indeed, upon my servants, that is masculine ones, and feminine bondwomen, female slaves, upon my male and female slaves, in those days, ech ke'o apatu pneumatosmu, I will pour out from my spirit, and kai prophetu sosen su sen, they will prophesy. Rounding off by sort of just repeating the same ideas again. Verse 19, kai doso terata en to urano ano kai semea epitesges kato. And I will, here again, dido me in a kind of causative sense. I will cause to appear, or can simply translate it, I will give wonders in heaven, ano, up above, and signs, epitesges, on the earth, kato, that is down below. So not only is this inclusive of all ranges and sexes of humanity, but this will include the whole cosmos, from heaven above to earth down below. Now, what signs and wonders? Haima kai pir kai atmida kapnu. The first there are fairly easy. Blood and fire, but then atmida. Atmis is a vapor, and kapnu is a kind of smoke. Bedag suggests here, putting the two together, you get steaming smoke, certainly something that will be visible. With fire and blood, is there a suggestion of color there? It's hard to say. But certainly things that will be noticed and seen by all. Verse 20, ha helios metastrophesetai es skotos kai he selene es haima. The sun will be changed or altered into darkness. So the very source of light now becomes in this case, perhaps even a cause, something that bears darkness, as Bedag suggests. And the moon will be then turned to blood. Here, Bedag suggests this is indicating a color and in apocalyptic terms, a red moon is an indication of something disastrous. Now, prin el thane hemeron kiriu tain megalain kai epiphane. Prin here, followed by the aorist infinitive with an accusative subject, means before. It's an adverb that here really serves as a conjunction. Before the day of the Lord, the great and epiphane, the glorious, remarkable, splendid one, comes. So all these things will happen before that great day appears, but in connection with it, the implication is as warnings that that day is near or at hand. Kai estai poshos an epikalesetai ta anima kiriu sothesetai. Again, we have the kai estai. And it will be, it will come about that pas hos an. Everyone who, with on, then the on makes this into a contingency, really the equivalent of a third-class condition here, so that the contingency isn't so much on whether the action of the verb will happen, but it's on the agent, the doer. So whoever, and it will come to pass that whoever epikalesetai, to call upon, to invoke the name of the Lord, he will be saved. So no matter who it is, this will come about. You can see, of course, how significant that is then for what follows in Peter's message, when this will be the time to call upon the name of the Lord and to be saved. That is the passage. There are any number of ways this can be developed in terms of preaching on Pentecost for this day. It certainly is a great service to our congregations just to rehearse again with them the events of this wonderful day, especially in light of the way they're interpreted against its scriptural background, especially drawing connections out, that is, with the Joel passage. Note also that this is a harvest day. This is the beginning of the great ingathering. And as the early harvest, it indicates whether or not the final one will be promising, fruitful, and good. And there's every indication here at this point that it will be just that, partly because all of this is happening under the direction of the power of God through His Spirit. There are other connections that can be made here, certainly in terms of Pentecost as recognizing in the work of Christ the turning point in history, so that Peter can say, we are now in the last days. These signs have been happening. This is the day to call upon the name of the Lord and be saved by Him. There's also the connection then, of course, with the promise of Jesus, that Jesus is no longer visibly present to His apostles, but His word still stands true. What He says still comes to pass, and He fills His own apostles with power so that they can become His witnesses. This passage doesn't give us the conclusion of the day's events with the repentance of the great crowd in Jerusalem on that day, but I think our people are familiar enough with the story that they will remember that's where this all led. The sermon as it follows is certainly beautiful and rich with theological content and points for development. There would certainly be no reason a preacher couldn't continue to move beyond simply the Joel passage into the rest of it, anticipating a little bit some of the other readings of the season. I think I will simply stop there. I think any more suggestion on how this might be developed may prove more limiting than helpful. I hope, looking at the passage, seeing how it all fits together, seeing some of the words and some of perhaps unusual ones, seeing the scope of the group that was gathered there, that will get you to the text and let the text then be the inspiration for your message. Thank you.